Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The morning after the State of the Union, and we're doing something we have not done ever before. We have a four-way podcast. We have Jim Swift, Andrew Egger, and JVL all on this program. So welcome. Good morning. You know, congratulations in surviving the State of the Union address.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Okay, we have to start off with this, though, since, you know, there's all this discussion about the media, the role of the media, fake news. And I have a case of fake news that I need to talk about this morning. First of all, I have to admit, I really don't know who Andy Cohen is.
The New Year's Eve guy from CNN?
Yeah.
Comedian?
Okay, Andrew, did you know who Andrew...
Not until I saw that piece of paper you're waving around right now.
Okay, because I see you're actually Googling the name Andy Cohen. Okay.
Well, it's important to be informed about these things before you open your mouth.
As millennials do.
Okay. JVL, you know who Andy Cohen is?
I have no idea.
Good. Okay. I was really feeling a little bit out of the loop about all of this. You know, Bravo's Andy Cohen. So he was the guy that co-hosted on CNN?
Yeah, with... what's his name?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, it is not a.
He replaced the Trump beheading comedian.
Kathy
Griffin.
Kathy Griffin. Yeah, he replaced Kathy Griffin on CNN with Anderson Cooper.
See, I was afraid I was going to bring this up, and then you guys were all going to start dragging me because he represents some great meme or narrative in popular culture that I don't know about. So here is the story, in case you have not seen it from CNN. CNN, which obviously should know him, right?
Yeah.
Bravo's Andy Cohen welcomes baby boy via surrogate. Andy Cohen is a dad, which obviously comes to his news to most of you since you didn't even know who he was.
Congratulations.
The host of Bravo's Watch What Happens Live posted on Instagram on February 4th that his son Benjamin Allen Cohen was born via surrogate earlier in the day. This is a thing apparently that they do. I don't know. He is named after my grandfather Ben Allen. The post said, "I'm in love and speechless and eternally grateful to an incredible surrogate who's apparently disposable now. I don't know, but and I'm a dad. Wow, family means everything to me, and having one of my own is something I've wanted in my heart for my entire life." Cohen, now we're getting to the reason I'm bringing this up, okay, because you're all wondering, why are we talking about this guy we don't know anything about? Cohen revealed the child's gender on New Year's Eve. A January baby shower featured the many stars of the Real Housewives series, singer John Mayer, and political commentator Charlie Sykes.
Hey!
No, I don't even know this guy.
Was it a nice ceremony? How was the food?
Well, I'm trying to figure out because there's actually a picture of this party. See the picture with all the Real Housewives?
Yeah, I'm not picking you out among the housewives.
No, you're not picking me out because I'm not there because I don't know this guy. And it's like, well, this is just fake news. And what I'm afraid of course, is that somebody in the future will Google me, and this will be the one thing that will survive. Everything else will be wiped off the internet except the fact that I showed up at this guy's baby show.
Tomorrow on American Greatness, Charlie shows up at a birthing party and gender reveal a la The Handmaid's Tale.
Okay, now JVL, do you ever worry?
You gotta send him a baby gift. No, I'm totally serious. It would be the coolest move ever. You just send him, be like, I'm sorry I didn't make it to the party that we were supposed to be at together, but really, really happy for you and the kid. By the way, I mean, I don't like to harsh on other people's parenting skills, but putting out the kid's full name and birth date on the internet, I'm sorry, does he not have this kid's social security number to put out there too? Like, he's just screwed this kid's online privacy for the rest of his life.
Well, is it a pre-doc? It's like a pre-doxing.
Yeah, well, no, he's pre-doxed his own kid.
Well, he's got a great future already lined up as a LifeLock spokesman now.
But if I'd actually been at the baby shower, I might have made this point to him, right? I might have been able to bring this up. Do you ever worry about this? Is like what gets preserved and what gets lost? Because I actually worry about this. Because, by the way, you can tell I'm filibustering because I don't want to talk about the State of the Union address, which I hate. But you worry about what you forget and what's going to be left. So I actually do this little thing, an app called the Happy Feed, where you have to remember three good things that happened to you today. And then you go back. And I have to do this because you get to a certain age and whole years of your life begin to disappear. And I was looking at it yesterday. And it will tell you what you did 9 months ago, 6 months ago, 3 months ago, 1 month ago. And 9 months ago, I have a little entry, you know, really fun podcast for the Daily Standard.
Speaking of things that have disappeared.
Okay, see, now you're ahead of me here. And I'm looking at that going, hey, what was the really fun podcast that I'm being reminded of from 9 months ago? And I realized it doesn't exist. It was just vaporized. It felt like a little death. You know what I'm saying, JVL? I mean, you know.
That kind of little death or the different kind of little death?
Yeah, whichever kind you want to go for here.
Take your pick.
You know, I mean, this is the reality that we do these things online. They're part of our lives. And some, you know, corporate, you know, ogre comes along and just basically presses a button and it gets wiped out.
Charlie, it's proof that the internet is not forever. Everyone likes to say, like from the movie The Social Network, the internet's forever. It's written in ink. It's not. It goes away.
That's true, by the way. That's a cliche we tell each other, you know, that, you know, your permanent record is out there. It's on your permanent record, and I mean, it's the internet.
You still shouldn't
only
do
the bad things stick around.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, but you still shouldn't do stupid things online. I mean, I think it is a good, like, rule to aspire to.
Okay, so we did 200 Daily Standard podcasts?
Over the course of many years, we did over 1,000. You and I did at least 200.
Right, and they've been just wiped out by the people who said they were going to preserve the archives. And you've done you did how many substandard?
I produced over 1,000. Yeah. JVL's
the substandard though.
How many did we do, Jim? I don't remember the full number of them.
I think it was like close to 150.
Yeah, something like that. That's okay. That show didn't actually have anything good in it.
But still, you know
who's really missing out on that is the advertisers. I mean,
yeah. Well, except that all of that, all the wit and the insight has been vaporized. But someone in the future will go back and they will Google my name and think, hey, he was at a baby shower for this guy he never heard of. So there is that. Okay. So do we have to talk about the State of the Union before we do this?
Speaking of the whole problem of what's going to be remembered a week from now, the State of the Union, probably not in that category, right?
Yes.
Today, a week from however, now. How about by dinner tonight?
Well, hopefully people will still be contemplating that if they're, you know, listening to this podcast.
Transition over. Andrew Eger is the best Andrew Eger.
Yeah, you bet.
Well, this used to be the joke, which is that, you know, how long was the over-under? How long will we forget whatever was happening this day? And you could never underestimate overestimate how fast you were going to forget things. Okay, but Ralph Northam, speaking of things that we forgot, you know, the governor of Virginia was dead on Saturday morning. Everybody was assuming that he was gone. The Democratic Party was piling on. There was just no way he was going to survive. And here we are on Wednesday, and it seems like, wow, that just dropped out of the news cycle. You have the lieutenant governor who's got his own Me Too. So, JV, you had a really interesting piece the other day where you did a game theory explaining why it actually made no sense for Northam to resign. And at the time you wrote that, it really seemed like an outlier because, of course, he was going to resign any minute now, right? As you're writing that, you're going, okay, am I going to get this up before he actually resigns? But now it appears that it was prescient, that he's gamed it out. So explain the game theory, why this guy is at least not resigning in the foreseeable next 10 minutes.
Right. So game theory is all about incentive structures. And when you look at the incentive structures for a politician who is facing an existential crisis, you've got to think, well, what does he gain by leaving versus what does he gain by sticking out? And in a state like Virginia, where there is no reelection, there's almost no mechanism to recall a governor. What are you going to do to the guy? Right. I mean, if he decides to stay, what is it that you can penalize him with? And the answer is there isn't very much versus what are his incentives to leave? And with something like this, Northam is not a rich guy. He's very well to do, as pediatric neurologists tend to be and should be. He started his own medical practice. But that's not like live the rest of your life money. Right. I mean, that's not what family money is or tech money is or something like that. So if he were to leave in disgrace, how would his pediatric practice reabsorb him? Like, he's currently on leave for it. Be like, hey, don't worry, our African-American employees and patients, we've just got this guy who thinks the Klan is a joke and likes dressing up in blackface here. It's OK. You know, like, he has to have privileges at local hospitals. Are the committees that do that going to want to take whatever heat comes with giving him privileges or not? Probably not. So how is he going to earn a living? And so you got to like look for, well, what are the actual on ramps or off ramps rather for these things? And normal people look at it and say, oh, well, my normal values and mores would lead me to be so ashamed that I would not be able to like even bear to be in public life. And so I'd want to slink away in shame. But people who run for office are not normal people. And people who think that like dressing up in blackface and being in the Klan is kind of funny aren't normal people either. So like all of what we're doing is we are, you know, committing the fallacy of imposing our own values on him. And when you look at other politicians in recent times who have faced big existential crises, their survival rate by brazing it out is basically 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at Trump or Clinton or even Trent Lott, you don't survive it all the time by just sticking, but you can survive it at least as often as not. And there is no downside for trying to survive it and then losing.
And well, especially given the pace of the news cycle, you know, the fact that people forget it, that if you can just hang on for that, you know, 48, 72 hours, things are going to change. I'm guessing that somewhere there's a former senator from Minnesota who is crying softly thinking about all this.
Yeah,
100%. I mean, if Al Franken would have just hung on for another week or so.
People were already starting to sort of come around on him, and then he ended up becoming sort of like a martyr figure for a lot of these people. Whereas if he just stuck around, he could have been a martyr figure, you know, just in office. That would have been
but important
well
to
him.
Recognize Al Franken doesn't get any extra credit for that. I mean, this is, you know, if you are Al Franken, now he has entertainment money and he's older and, you know, you could see where he might be able to somehow resurrect himself later on. But Al Franken doesn't get any credit for being like the nice guy who did that. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand knifed him because she wanted to start pivoting to Me Too stuff. And she's going to keep climbing. He disappears into, you know, semi-repugnant obscurity. And it was just a mistake. Now, I should say none of this is good.
No.
The fact that we have wound up with these incentive structures in our political square is really bad. Like I said this in my piece, you know, you look back on the Nixon years and it is now by today's political standards, the idea that Richard Nixon resigned without like forcing a total showdown fight over this and saying it's a binary choice and blah, 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 blah. Like nowadays, that looks like weak and crazy. And why would he do that? And this guy was adhering to some Bushido code of morality.
Well, yeah, but he had no choice at that point. Right.
Well, you know, we think he had no choice, but I don't know if he had. If he had really stuck it out and said, I'm going to force a supermajority of the Senate to vote to convict me, I don't know. I mean, people forget there was, it is different to have people quietly in your office saying, I'm not going to support you versus publicly then having to face down the party establishment, right? Because one assumes that the Trumpers of the time would have looked on how could you betray, you know, Dick Nixon after all he's done for us and you're denying the will of the voters. And look, he won the biggest popular landslide we've had in, you know, 40 years at that point. Right. I mean, his reelect was an enormous success. So anyway, I would say those days now, the days of Watergate look like the days of moral clarity in America.
Oh, absolutely.
JBL, I thought it was interesting you brought up Kirsten Gillibrand because not only did she knife Al Franken in the chest, she also knifed Bill Clinton, and the Clintons are a huge reason why Kirsten Gillibrand is a thing. And if I may, you know, help us pivot to the State of the Union, last night, most of the female lawmakers, a lot of them freshmen in the House, were all wearing white. Kirsten Gillibrand was wearing black.
Oh, really?
Missed opportunity.
Huh. Interesting.
It's going to be great when she goes all Black Lives Matter on Kamala Harris over like her record as state AG. No, I'm serious.
You know,
like,
it's coming.
100% it's going to be wonderful.
It's coming.
And she'll be the one who's willing to go there. Like everybody else is going to be like, I don't know. And Gillibrand is like the Terminator. Like
certainly the most ruthless member of the prospective Democratic 100%. Class. Yes.
Well, we will get to the State of the Union, but I just want to stick on this point because I think you made a really interesting point here about why you brazen it out that if you are Al Franken or if you're, you know, the governor of Virginia who resigns, what you do is you take that scandal and you put a big red line under it. This becomes one of the defining things. It becomes the first sentence in your Wikipedia entry that you resign if you brazen it out, if you manage to survive, if there's 50-50, then it becomes, you know, Al Franken, who served for, you know, 28 years in the Senate, blah, 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 blah. And in, like, paragraph number 18, it mentions, you know, for a brief while, he was under fire because of this, Me Too thing. But, right, I mean, it's a, if you resign, it becomes the defining moment of your entire life.
Yes.
If you brazen it out and you survive, it becomes a footnote.
Yes. I mean, just like Al Franken. I mean, right. that was the mistake for Franken to resign is Al Franken's never going to be president.
Right.
He's never going to get elected to any higher office than U.S. senator. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a shock to maybe some of us that he got there in the first place. But that was the pinnacle of his life, and he left. Now, him leaving his pinnacle is his story.
You know, I actually, this whole the death sentence for people in Me Too, I just have a random thought that you have guys who are really in the prime of life, and I'm not expressing sympathy. I'm just curious. You know, for example, the guy I'm thinking of is Mark Halperin. You know, political reporter, his whole life has been doing this. You know, after his Me Too scandal, he basically suffered a professional death penalty, and I actually do wonder what do they do all day. I mean, I'm serious. You're a smart guy. You're watching the news. This is your whole life. You've done this. You can't do TV. You can't write. You're not gonna. You can't blog. You don't
can't even
do anything.
You can't even tweet because anything you tweet, it's gonna be like, okay, serial harasser.
A life without Twitter is no life at all. No, but I mean, like, there's plenty of faceless jobs for a well-connected guy in Washington where you can be behind the scenes.
What do you think Halperin's doing?
Consulting, probably.
Yeah.
Well, he's like smart, that. But I just know. Okay. We have to do this because there was the State of the Union, and I read over the weekend, you know, Peggy Noonan's breathless, piece where she talked about how important it was, this Democratic ritual, and how she was among those who got goosebumps when the door opens. I have to tell you, I've never gotten goosebumps watching it, and I think that the trivialization of that speech is just, it's gotten to the point where almost every conversation now is about who clapped. Well, who didn't clap? What was Nancy Pelosi's condescending little, oh, you were such a good boy clap, which is actually a pretty good meme.
Only a former White House speechwriter gets goosebumps on the State of the Union.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the things that if we did not have the State of the Union, this would have been one of the positive developments of 2019.
I think where we're going with this, Charlie, yeah, is like next year. I mean, the cameras in the House of Representatives are governed by the House of Representatives,
yeah,
and they've allowed C-SPAN in there, and they give C-SPAN access to their feeds. I'm not sure the Democrats are going to do this. I'm not sure the Republicans are going to do this, but eventually somebody is going to weaponize those cameras, and there's always going to be like a live feed. Like, I pay for NHL TV because I like watching the St. Louis Blues lose. They won last night. I watched the Blues win and the State of the Union. But they're going to offer these extra feeds where you can zoom in on every single member and you can, you know, see who clapped at what, you know, America is not a socialist nation. You know, who didn't clap?
Who's nodding off? Who's picking their nose?
Right. It's going to become tantamount to voting in Congress as to whether or not you clapped for an applause line.
You think our politics is not enough of a hellscape? We have to have something like that?
I'm just predicting it's going to get worse.
Okay. So, JVL, your hot take on the speech last night.
I actually just wrote a piece about this, which I'm not sure if we're going to run later today or tomorrow. It is possible that what we saw was the preview of his big election pitch, mm-hmm, which is going to be America First versus socialism, and that they're going to make this the Flight 93 election, mm-hmm, part two. And if that is the case, if that's what he's really going with, it will be highly interesting. And it will have a kernel of truth to it because the Democratic nominee is likely to embrace a number of positions which are at least vaguely socialist. The big problem is that our current Republican conservative president embraces or has recently embraced almost all of those vaguely socialist positions himself. So, you know.
Well, you know, it is true, and I do think that in the last week, it was interesting to watch how the Democrats really lost two narratives on two major issues, the issue of partial birth abortion and the issue of Medicare for All, when even the mainstream media began describing that as a plan to take away millions of people's private health insurance. Once that issue is cast in that way, it completely flips. It is a complete loser. Also, if you want to talk about abortion, the one thing you do not want to talk about is the late term partial birth abortion and infanticide. And suddenly they flipped on both those. But I was struck by just the phoniness of this speech, including the appeals for unity. Later we learned, you know, that he'd met with reporters in the Oval Office, and even on this day, rips John McCain. He cannot get John McCain out of his head, you know, and he's insulting all of these folks. So that was empty. And Andrew, I thought you did a pretty interesting piece doing the sort of, let's break it down, what was, in terms of Trump, what was Trump and what was put into his mouth? So
before we get there, yeah, I mean, okay. the Trumps take bullying very seriously.
Oh, God.
You know, I mean... You know, they had that kid last night. And look, bullying is universally bad. Kids shouldn't be bullied. But, I mean, the bullier in chief, I mean, it's not sincere.
Well, it's a way for him to be like, I'm a victim, you know, and you're victims on my behalf. You know, if you support me, you are martyred because of your faith in me.
And the kid fell asleep, too.
So you did identify, Andrew, one, what you thought was, and I don't disagree with you on this, one authentic Trump moment. Well, authentic with quotes on it.
Right. Well, I mean, there were a few times, you know, when he would, you know, riff on something, that how something was playing in the crowd. And obviously Trump is pretty good at this sort of thing, where he's sort of playing off the crowd energy and ad-libbing and things like that. The problem is that usually he's breaking in to talk about what he's really focused on, which is sort of how he is going to come off in the whole speech. So there was this nice moment where they were honoring a Holocaust survivor who was also who had also survived the Tree of Life mass shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh last year, and it also happened to be his birthday yesterday, and so he got a nice round of applause. And then there was this very tuneless but also kind of nice spontaneous singing of happy birthday to him, and you know, Trump sort of conducted it a little with his hands, and it was very fun. And but then his like ad lib at the end was, you know they would never do that for me, which was it was pure Trump. That's what you sign up for, right?
It had to be about him,
yeah,
right?
I mean, so, like, and maybe you find that kind of innocuous, and maybe you find that kind of insulting, but it's very much on brand for him.
And that's the moment you ran to your keyboard and wrote, this was the moment when Donald Trump became president.
Yes. Right. I thought it was interesting that you brought up Peggy Noonan earlier, because I sort of wanted to mention that sort of thing, because the big question of the State of the Union and these sort of marquee speeches for Trump is always, well, is this interesting? You know, all these calls for unity, all these calls for bipartisanship. Is this some new face turn for the president that we haven't seen before? And obviously, it's a ridiculous question, because the question comes up every time, and we always find out later, no, it wasn't a big new turn. It's just, you know, he's sort of gesturing in this direction. But the thing that occurs to me, and the thing that I sort of get into in the piece that I have up on the site this morning, is that it's for the sort of Peggy Noonans of the world that Trump makes these sort of transparently transactional gestures, right? Where it's people who it's Republicans who sort of begrudgingly came around to him in the first place, who still support him, but who crave reassurance that all of the warnings about Trump's damage to our institutional norms and things like that are overblown, and that actually he's just going to be around for a short while, and we're going to outlast him, and the downsides will not end up being as bad as they have appeared to be. And people who see a speech like this where Trump, you know, gets up on stage and he says every Republican platitude that any Republican president would end. He ends with a big sort of sweeping rhetorically sweeping, I mean, he was kind of flat in his delivery, but whatever, I mean, this big pitch about, you know, how our best days are ahead of us, we have not yet begun to dream of what we're capable of. I mean, just obviously not Trump's own rhetoric.
The Peggy Noonans of the world got goosebumps.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what it's for, because we talk about, you know, how ultimately this speech is kind of meaningless, and we'll all have forgotten about it in a week because we're sort of dipped in the news cycle, and we're going to be on to the next thing. Right. But for a certain subset of the Republican base, for these people that I'm talking about, who are sort of more traditionally conservative but still flock to Trump, these kind of moments are the things that they cling to for a long time, I think, and that they sort of keep in their minds to sort of weather the storms of the much more embarrassing and sort of temperamental moments of the president.
And they need them. Let's go to some of the sound bites here, and you highlighted some of them, Andrew, at least on your Twitter feed last night. This one was the one where he. Well, we'll play it, but it's the one where he's sort of contrasting. You can either legislate or investigate. It's obviously there's a writer there who's feeling, you know, deeply proud.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. We must choose between greatness or gridlock, results or resistance, vision or vengeance, incredible progress or pointless destruction.
Who actually thought that was a good line in the speech?
Whoever wrote it.
Yeah.
Well. And this is good writing.
And there, you know, there were some of the usual sort of base whisperers on Twitter saying, like, actually, a bit outside the Beltway, that played really well. But if you going into the State of the Union, if your big hope was that he would sort of shout out Robert Mueller and sort of dunk on him obliquely, then I guess you were cheered by that line. But I mean, he wasn't making any like particularly interesting point. He was basically just saying, like, if you want to pass more legislation, then we should stop this Mueller investigation.
Well, it's kind of an implied threat, right? Is if you keep doing these investigations, we're not going to be able to get this legislation.
Well, what's he going to pass anyway? You know, Mueller or not, there's no real appetite.
I was taken by the response. Democrats laughed at it.
Yeah.
And this was like one of the few things I tweeted. I thought they were right to laugh at it. You know, they are a co-equal branch of government, and they are, you know, well within the rights to investigate him, especially after House Republicans dropped the ball and, you know, played a game of hide the ball. So, you know, people who support Trump might think this is, you know, a really well-written line that, you know, is so presidential, but I thought it was a laugh track.
No, I thought it was you know, Stephen Miller, sitting in his underwear writing, you know, great moments of presidential prose. Okay, here's another soundbite that frankly I had missed until Andrew you called attention to it when he's talking about his support for, and again, this is a major theme, obviously, for the Republican base, and given the events of the last several weeks, bring up the right to life. And this is the way he did it. And you have to listen kind of closely to this.
All children, born and unborn, are made in the holy image of God. The final part of my agenda is to protect American security.
It feels like there's almost something missing. So he has this line about the unborn, and how did you describe it? I mean, he doesn't even pause for it, and just rolls onto something else, and is like, wait. You're reading the speech. There was no emphasis on it whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. So one of the big questions going into the State of the Union was whether Trump was going to work in this issue that has become really big among Republicans and conservatives in just the past couple of days since the Northam comments, where he sort of danced around the concept of infanticide, and Senator Ben Sasse introduced a bill, you know, that would strengthen penalties on abortionists if they didn't try to resuscitate infants born alive after a failed abortion attempt, things like that. So the question was whether he was going to lean into that. And he did. He called for Congress to pass a ban on abortions after fetuses are capable of feeling pain. That was a big applause line for him. And he leaned into that rhetorically. The thing that was interesting right there, I mean, it's always clear when Trump talks about life issues that he's sort of reading off a script, right? And maybe you care about that.
Are you suggesting he's insincere?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the easy dunk, right? I mean, like, yeah, you don't really care about the unborn, whatever. But, you know, again, to get back to sort of the point I was making before, people don't care, and maybe they're right not to care. I mean, maybe they're right. It might be enough if life issues are your big cause. It might be enough that Trump, you know, was willing to sort of woodenly read all of these lines of support for your cause off the prompter. I mean, his heart's not in it, but he's gonna get behind it legislatively whenever you need him to. And you know, that's realistically, I mean, that's sort of all they're really want out of him.
Sincerity used to matter in these things.
Oh, yeah, I mean, for
no,
sure.
No, like, and at least you could pretend he was sincere.
Yeah, and right. Someone who, like, you know, as a high school student, spoke at Right to Life marches and went to Catholic schools, I mean, I believe very sincerely in stopping abortion.
No, yeah, I mean, I'm 100%. I'm personally right there with you. I'm just saying, like, you know, if you're pro-life and you have a president who may be personally pro-life and may not be personally pro-life, it's perhaps, you know, encouraging for you to see that he at least feels the political need to gesture in your direction, right? I mean, like, that's really all I'm trying to get at. And that sort of comports with the conversations I've had with pro-life people at the March for Life.
Yeah, and I guess my criticism is that it's become so much more transactional. Like, if you weren't, like, super sincerely on board with the pro-life movement, people would, you know, suggest you were a phony. And now we have a phony who just, like, makes gestures, and they're like, this is awesome.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah,
Andrew, actually, I would argue that this is a step backwards for the pro-life movement, because the pro-life movement went through a phase of driving out the pro-choice elements of the Republican Party and was pretty successful at that, and then got to a point of wanting people who weren't just genuflecting because they felt it was a political necessity, but were doing it because they believed in it. Yeah, and that was like the last 15 years or so of Republican politics. Mm-hmm. And moving backwards to a place where you have a guy who really doesn't believe it and has no interest in using the sort of persuasive power of the office to move the culture on this stuff is actually a step backwards. This is worse for Republicans and worse for the pro-life movement than things were 10 years ago. And when you look at the long game, I mean, the long game of this really is about moving public opinion, because mm-hmm. the Supreme Court cannot and will not follow, or we cannot and will not get really far out of public opinion. I mean, this is just the court has shown over and over again that it won't do that.
Right.
And to get the rulings you really want, you have to move public opinion. And having a guy like Trump, who is so polarizing and so hated, really actually hurts the movement in very concrete ways. It isn't good enough to have a guy who will just stand up for you like on two votes a year or something. Like, that's the pro-life movement needs better than that.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I mean, on a personal level, I totally 100% agree with that. I think he's been catastrophic for the movement, set it back. I'm just sort of trying to get in the headspace of people who watched that speech, saw those moments, and appreciated all that. Which, I mean, for a lot of Republicans, that was the response.
Well, my concern is that, like, the next step for this is like we're like 4 or 6 years out from having a Republican who, I mean, it used to be that you couldn't say you were for tariffs, and now Trump said, well, you can show you're for tariffs if you're right attitudinally. And why is it that pro-lifers believe that their issue is different than like trade or the free market or anything? You know, I'm
well, and
like, remember when particularly Trump, if you're said, right, you're like, hey, it's the Republican Party, not the Conservative Party. Right. If I was a pro-lifer, what worries me is that Trumpism shows that your issue can be next.
And
6 years from now, you're going to have a guy who comes out and says, look, you know, I'm personally for life, but I'm not going to, you know, impose my views on this, and I don't care what the crazy pro-lifers say.
Bill Weld's running for president as a Republican.
and your point is, this battle is going to be fought in the culture and in public opinion, and if public opinion, in fact, does turn against the pro-life movement and they become more marginalized in the polls, that scenario that you describe is more likely. I'll tell you where I've, I believe, sort of become a convert on this particular issue. For, I would say, 15 years or more, every year I was the MC for the Wisconsin Right to Life Dinner, and which is a very, very successful organization, Wisconsin Right to Life. And one of the things that they did was they pursued, of course, the regular Right to Life agenda, but also they put a lot of money and a lot of resources into ads that were targeted to young men and women, just not about the legalities of abortion, but just like, you know, there are people here for you. You want to choose life. You know, understand the dilemma that you face. They were very, very well done. And over the course of that decade and a half, you began to see a shift in the culture where the abortion rate was going down. And I think it was because people were being persuaded to make a different choice. And I think that's the predicate for you know, the broader end of abortion, that you have to change those attitudes. And I do think that this may be counterproductive. Okay, enough about the State of the Union address. We got to talk about Seb Gorka. Hottest thing on our website right now is
Gorka. What a mind.
Okay, so JB, tell me about how people want to, you know, say, so what are you guys doing at the Bulwark? And today there seems to be a little bit of a narrative on social media that you guys at the Bulwark are having way too much fun, which I think it may be true.
Yeah, absolutely. I got into fights with Montessori Nation yesterday.
Yep. Well, you attacked Montessori by saying it was like the White House. No, it was the other way around, right? You know.
No, I mean, Molly Jong Fast. I mean, my piece was very small and nowhere near as good as Molly's. Molly's Gorka piece is fantastic.
But you need to read it. You need to read your Montessori piece. You need to read Rick Wilson's preview of the State of the Union Address, Safe for Work.
Yeah, go to thebulwark.com and just click everything. Yeah, just go on down the line.
Okay, but tell me about this. The Seb Gorka thing is really a thing of beauty. And I don't know, is anybody here not blocked by Seb Gorka?
Blocked.
JVL?
Blocked.
Yeah.
Totally blocked.
He's a snowflake. He's a snowflake who drives a four-cylinder Mustang.
You're a fascist dragon.
Can I defend him on this?
Sure.
The four-cylinder Mustang or the blocking?
No, JBL's a blocking truther now.
I really, truly believe in the Marie Kondo view of Twitter, which is that if someone does not bring you joy, you should block them.
Yeah.
Right? You don't work for Twitter. Twitter works for you. And so if my tweets about, Star Wars and whatever don't bring Dr. Gorka joy, then I'm happy to have him block me. I think that's okay. I'm not going to drag him on that.
Well, I don't think Gorka adopts the Marie Kondo view of not bringing you joy because he, Dan Bongino, for example, repeatedly talk about people. Like Sean Davis, like people that they block, they still talk about them. You're living rent free. It isn't like, oh, I hate this person. I never want to see them in my life. When someone appears, I just mute them. Seb Gorka, Dan Bongino, Sean Davis, they still talk about them despite blocking them. Like this is not like a healthy thing.
Okay, so JVL, what was, just for the people who are listening to the podcast who haven't seen the piece, what was your favorite line? I know you were debating this one.
It's very, very difficult. Yeah. I mean, there's the Olmec head line, which is genius, and you have to go see just the art that our great Hannah Yost did for this is amazing. It has both a dragon and an Olmec head in it with the Gorka and the Hungarian flag.
Don't forget the assault rifle.
And the assault rifle, but it might be the part where he talks about, he's very alpha. He's a very alpha man and talks about how what he does for fun is he likes going to comic book and sci-fi shops and he's really into Judge Dredd. And
the era of the pajama boy is over and alpha males are back.
And then he admits that what he does for fun is he shoots machine guns and goes to comic book stores.
Yeah, because that's a super normal, well-adjusted alpha thing. That's,
Well, honestly, my favorite...
That's what real men do. That's what butch guys do.
My favorite moment of Molly's piece, which I think, is to give Gorka the credit where he's due, is at the end she says, just be warned. You may think that Sebastian Gorka is a ridiculous figure of fun, but someday the White House is going to be run by boring, semi-competent technocrats again, and you'll miss him. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, what are we going to do? I mean, the good news is that every figure who is even ancillarily connected to the Trump White House is going to get a spot on Trump's new cable news network when he leaves office. So we never really have to say goodbye to these people, but it will be it'll be a little sad not to see him.
There'll be a little
stomping around,
a little hole in our lives.
Yeah, I mean,
we are being entertained.
We can admit that, right?
We can admit that, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining me, Jim Swift, Andrew Egger, JVL. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do probably not this all over again, but we will do something all over again.